past 1 o'clock.
Good afternoon, and welcome to a WFPL news special on local food. I'm Gabe Bullard. With me are Proof on Main chef Michael Paley, farmer Ivor Chodkowski from Grasshoppers Distribution and Harvest Restaurant, Sarah Frischner with the Louisville Farm to Table Initiative, and Nathaniel Spencer of New Roots and the Shawnee Neighborhood Fresh Stop. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And joining us later will be Pierre Derichet, a professor and author of the as-yet-unreleased The Locavore's Dilemma. That's a book he's working on. And we also want to hear from you. Give us a call at 502-814-8255. You can email to news@wfpl.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WFPL News. I want to start this segment and the show with an explanation. So first, and feel free anyone to jump in here, on the criteria for local food. When someone talks about local food, what is the definition of that?
Well, for me, this is Sarah. For me, it's about it involves the Kentucky borders, and that's just because my position is grant funded, and that's what the people who give me the money are worried about. They're worried about tobacco farmers growing food, so I worry about Kentucky mostly.
And from a restaurant perspective, it's definitely the Ohio River Valley, Kentucky, so into Indiana as well. So,
and Ivor?
I agree with that as well. So at the Restaurant Harvest, we have a 100-mile radius from which we draw, and it's somewhat arbitrary, but it makes sense and includes many folks who are within the region producing sustainably and making their product available to us. So.
And as far as eating locally, is there, how much of the diet should be local? How much of the average meal should be local?
Well, maybe a more interesting question would be how much of it could be. And just to think about, for example, at Grasshoppers, how convenient it is to get a year-round local grocery subscription. And at the restaurant at Harvest, we plan to do 80% local year-round. There's now 2 farmers markets open year-round, so if people are willing to be somewhat flexible and think about eating seasonally, it's really a year-round opportunity.
And there are some items, though, that would not be able to be local, coffee, certain things like that, certain grains, perhaps?
We make reasonable exceptions, coffee, chocolate, some wines.
And so what are the advantages, then, of using local food, say, for instance, in a restaurant?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, go back, grains, actually, we get some great grains from Midway, Kentucky. So there are, and that's definitely a year-round source, so that's a great thing. We'll ask your question one more time.
Oh, what are the advantages, say, in a restaurant of using local items?
You know, I think it's just kind of how we do our business. We love the seasonality of it. We love training our staffs. So we love having the guests be able to have that as an option in the whole, you know, the world of restaurants here and everywhere else. It's something that it's engaging for us as chefs. And when you really kind of get down into it and start working with the farmers and the farms, like our farm, Woodland Farm, we start every season, planting season in the fall, just kind of reading seed catalogs and planning what we want to grow. And we use the previous year's experience as far as what worked and what didn't. And Stephanie Tittle and I, who's our grower at Woodland Farm, she plots out the space that we have. And, you know, we talk about what we want to grow. And I think from there, we can start going past the, you know, your staples like squash, say summer heirloom tomato squash and zucchini, and like just getting into the world of eggplants, for example. We grew all different varieties of those, and it's really fun to have those things that you don't normally work with or see, but to even to teach yourself that there's so many varieties of just eggplant out there, or peppers, or sizes and shapes of tomatoes. So it's from a restaurant perspective, it's a lot of fun.
I'd like to turn to you, Sarah Frischner and Nathaniel Spencer. What about getting this food onto people's tables, local food? We've seen farmers markets come up. We're seeing the city especially fostering some new farmers markets. But what are the advantages of using that, of using local food at home, of me, say, as a consumer going out and buying local food?
Okay, well, this is Nathaniel. As far as with New Roots and the Fresh Stop programs,
it's extremely important to get these local foods from the local, you know, from the farmers, and getting it on the table of the communities. Our goal is to really feed what's known as the food deserts of our community. And in these communities, these people don't really have a great opportunity to get a lot of local foods. They're used to buying from the big stores, which come from California, Mexico, and all these other places. So we've introduced them to local farm fresh foods, and they appreciate it. They love it. You know, they've expressed how they can feel the difference in getting local farm fresh food versus food that may have come from another state. Getting it on the table is extremely important. And educating the people about not only where it comes from, but how to prepare it and even how to grow it.
And we'll be getting into that in just a little bit, some of the concepts around preparing and growing food even yourself. As far as the city goes, what are the advantages for the city in having more people eating food grown, say, within the Kentucky borders or within this area?
Well, let me just say that I got into this business through my degree in nutrition eons ago, but it was always my intent to help people learn how to eat well. And so I went around, crusading for fresh fruits and vegetables, for instance, and realized once when I had a fresh tomato that was locally grown somewhere else, not in Kentucky, but I just realized that there was something about fresh food that was lacking in the supermarket. And so that's when I sort of made the switch. Aha, you know, if it's locally grown, it tastes better. But then I began to get more involved in the other aspects of locally grown. So one of those is that you're buying from your neighbors. So that, you know, you support your neighbor supports you. But building on that is the whole economic development of building the economy. So that's where I work. I work in the economic development department. My goal is to make food available to everyone and not just to white tablecloth restaurants. So that, you know, that's beginning to filter down. Michael's new restaurant is Proof is pretty accessible, but the garage is pretty more accessible, and we want to bring it down the Bristol Bar and Grill, Bistro 301. As we bring that down in restaurants in average plate value, that's also a success. But more important is getting it into the school lunch program, which is also what I work on, getting it available to the students at U of L, which is also what I work on, making it available to everyone who works at Humana, which is also what I work on. So it's not just that we've had people leading the way. Michael Paley and Ivor have led the way, but we need everyone joining in. And that's what Louisville Farm to Table is about. It's about everyone joining in and making food accessible to everyone.
And this is a program that's been recognized by
nationally. The U.S. Conference of Mayors gave Mayor Fisher an award last June and said this is a livability that he got I can't remember the level, but it was like a premier prize in a livability, and it has been recognized nationally.
How does Louisville's program compare to those in other cities?
I don't know of any other program that is this exact program. There are other people who do foraging and finding people who and getting product for a certain place. There are places called food hubs where that aggregate product coming from the country to the city. And I would say my place, if there was an aggregation point like that, my place would be to go, hey, everybody, there's an aggregation point, you know, in a sort of systematic way. Do that with large providers, distributors, you know, try and make it available to everyone.
And what are the advantages, Ivor, I'll turn to you, for a farmer of growing food and selling it locally?
Well, it's nice to know your customers, and it's nice to be able to have that relationship. I think it's important, you know, for us, not just with restaurants and stores, but individually at farmers markets and through our CSA. And, just mentioning sort of food aggregation possibilities. So I own, like I said, Grasshoppers Distribution. Before, it's a locally owned company. We've returned $1.3 million to local farmers. We're not a big sort of out-of-state corporation that, doesn't care so much about relationships. We've been about them, you know, really from the beginning. And we want to continue to take advantage of that. And we sort of have as a part of our mission, caring for farmers. And on the other end, we really want to make it as convenient as possible for folks to be able to tap in to what's local in a way, you know, perhaps that's not quite as, you know, if some people have said, inconvenient as a farmer's market, because we really need to break this open a little bit more, make it available for more people. I agree with Sarah on that point.
Is it sustainable for a farmer to be selling, to only sell locally at this point?
I think it's probably the best route, especially for a small farmer. I think over the years, Sierra's position is funded by the Ag Development Board, which is the state board that was created through the tobacco settlement. And the Ag Development Board has done, you know, lots of good things. Certainly, however, there's been bad policy decisions in the past around agriculture, which revolve around getting too big too quickly. And leaving farmers really vulnerable to commodity-type market forces. And I think we believe at Grasshoppers, and a lot of small farmers believe that, you know, a somewhat more incremental approach with steps taken that are big, that are controlled and plotted, are the best way to protect farmers in the long run. So there's a lot of things to do. There's a lot more in your control locally than there is either, you know, in a big scale regionally, or nationwide, or whatever. We're you know, small farmers are just too vulnerable to participate in a system where there are futures of this and that, cattle and so on, grains, and it's a dangerous place for small people. So,
and in making the food more accessible, Nathaniel, if you could talk a little bit about New Roots and what you've been doing with that organization.
Well, the New Roots, of course, it's a nonprofit, a very small grassroots nonprofit organization, and that is part of their primary goal as well, is to bring accessibility of these farm fresh foods local to the urban community, food deserts, to help the disparities that's going on in our city, in these communities. Getting the local farmers involved is important, and not mean to switch over, but I have to give a lot of credit to Courtney Farms, because they were a tobacco farming facility, and you know they're stepping out to feed.
They're in Shelby County.
In Shelby County, and they thank you very much, sir. And they are really stepping out to feed this our city. Really, they're not just doing the roots. I mean, they're doing giving restaurants and other places. You know,
and the school lunch program.
And the school lunch program, and so that is something that they're stepping out on. And we have to support them because they have a family. And if, you know, where they come from and stepping out, we went out to their farm, and it was a group of 20 of us from the New Roots Shawnee Neighborhood Fresh Stop. And Mary Courtney, she expressed to us a lot about her history, her family history. And when she, you know, you see her kids there and you realize that, wow, these people really are putting something out there for us, but we have to give back to them by supporting them. And that's just, to me, it's very touching what she's doing and her family is doing for our city as a whole.
And you mentioned food deserts. We should explain food deserts. They're these areas, usually in cities, where local produce is not available for some miles. There isn't a grocery store. There isn't some place that stocks food, local or not, that it's fresh produce, fresh meat, anything like that.
Right.
And the city has done a number of things to open the Healthy in a Hurry corner stores, they're calling them, where making some of that produce available.
Right.
So just to mention that. Now, there is a perception out there, and as we were preparing for this show, we encountered this in the research, especially in some of the comments people had said, that eating local is a privilege for a lot of people, that there's the idea that local food is going to be more expensive. It's available in restaurants that are maybe out of the price range of some people, or not, more of a white tablecloth sort of thing at this point. So what do you do to either lower the cost or to change that perception, if that perception's inaccurate?
Well, in the case of New Roots, you know, first of all, we built the relationships with the farmers and built the trust factor with them to let them know that, you know, working together and the way how the community, these communities are working together to make it happen. I mean, giving access to the foods and enabling them to use their food stamp cards is one thing, you know, EBT, very important. We use a sliding scale with our program as well. So, you know, as long as we get 30% that's using food stamps, but yet we get 70% that are paying the full price for the shares, it's a way of subsidizing each other. So the community is actually supporting the community. People are supporting each other in this type of program. And then we're able to afford to pay the farmer, you know, what they deserve for their food, no question about it. And that's the key, is building that relationship to where you can negotiate fairly. And we fed over 400 people so far this year from June to now. We have another fresh stop coming up this Thursday at Redeemer Lutheran Church. And to be able to feed 400 people, to be able to educate them, to be able to give them the access to some of the foods they've never even seen before, it's pretty awesome, you know. And so the affordability is there. It's how you put it together. It's how you build that relationship with that farmer.
How many farmers markets in Louisville will accept EBT?
I think there are three. I'm not positive about this, but Gabe, I want to caution you that it's not all about farmers markets. Farmers markets are thriving in Louisville. There are a lot of them. They offer a great product, but there are many, many, many farmers who can't sell retail. They don't have the personality for it. They're not interested in it. And if you extrapolate food to clothes or cars or anything else, there are some people who can really get out there in the market and really do a good job. But other people, I met many farmers through this experience. My job is a little more than 2 years old now, who have no interest in selling retail. And those people will sell wholesale, and it is affordable to people who are buying in bulk, like the school lunch program. I mean, I harp on that, but that's, you know, that's 90,000 meals a day for school lunch and breakfast. And the fresh fruit and vegetable grant that the county schools have feed kids a fresh fruit or vegetable snack 3 days a week in 30 schools. And most of those are high free and reduced price lunch. So we're talking again about, you know, food deserty type areas. That's fresh fruit and vegetables. And the person who runs that program buys as much local as she can. And we're continuing to build. So again, this is a new process. We add every growing season, we're adding people. And people involved in those programs, a lot of them have said, "Uncle, I can't do retail anymore. I'll take a lesser price. I'll sell wholesale. I'll sell in bulk. I'll bring it all to one place, take a little bit lower amount of money for it, but to me, it's still a great income." And Mary Courtney is one of, at Courtney Farms in Shelby County, is one of those people.
And is there an effort underway to get this food then sold to grocery stores?
Well, there's an organization called Grow Farms, which is part of Horton Fruit Company, which is a very large, I mean, large for Louisville and large for this area, company. They deal in semi-loads, and Grow Farms deals only in Kentucky product, and they deal only with in semi-loads. So that's Kroger, Meijer, that kind of thing. So, and they've been talking to Gordon Food Service, GFS, so nothing has happened yet, but they are discussing. So again, the bigger the end result, the longer it takes to get there. You know, we can quickly turn around with others, but the bigger the fish, the longer it takes to land on the boat.
And turning to you, Michael and Ivor, how about this issue of accessibility? Your thoughts, maybe things you're doing around it?
You know, like Sarah mentioned, we opened our new restaurant, Garage Bar, which from our end, we wanted to bring the same sensibility and usage of the products that we use at Proof in a different price point, offering that to guests. You know, that wouldn't always come to Proof, and we definitely see a difference in the clientele there. So as far as the restaurant goes, that's, you know, how we attack that. But I agree with everybody. I think it's about awareness. And what I really like about the school programs is the best place to start is with the kids and their, you know, the families there, and just kind of making them aware of it. That's a great place to start. So restaurants are just a part of it.
And a great part, I think. They're our marketing. They're out there marketing, and they're the ones who are making it popular. But it is trickling down.
Now, an issue with food in schools, I can't remember her name, but working at JCPS, handling a lot of the nutrition, we've talked to her, FPL reporters have talked to her before, about this issue, about getting local food in. And there's a cost factor with what the school can afford as well. They have money coming in from the state, from the federal government, so much per meal.
Yes, and it's about a dollar.
Yeah, and so that extremely limits what they can do. Is there an effort to, obviously you couldn't undercut the farmers on this point, but as far as increasing that subsidy, is there any effort there underway?
Oh, well, Gabe, I think you should take that on and run regular programs on how underfunded school lunch is and get lots of people to come in and talk about that.
See what we can do.
Okay. Thank you.
This is going to bring us to our first break. We're talking about local food, and in just a minute, we'll hear from a critic of the locavore diet. And we also want to hear from you. Do you eat local? How much of your diet is local? And is local food easy to come by for you? Give us a call, 502-814-8255, news@WFPL.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well at WFPL News. And we've been talking about the farm-to-table concept here in the studio, but WFPL's Dalton Main went out to the field, literally, to find out more. Let's hear his report.
The farm-to-table concept has found a unique home in Louisville's East Market District, in a place called Harvest Restaurant. 1 week after opening in April, the restaurant received its first four-star review and has continued to impress patrons like Carolyn Claxton.
The food is just absolutely wonderful, just wonderful. I had a pork dish that was very special. But right now, the bread pudding with the bourbon sauce is by far the best.
Harvest is the brainchild of local farmer Ivor Chodkowski. The restaurant exists with one goal: to show the community the power of locally grown foods with gourmet meals. 80% of the food served at Harvest comes from within a 100-mile radius of the city, and much of it comes from Ivor's farm in the city. The Field Day Family Farm is an 8-acre strip of land between I-64 and Oxmoor Country Club. The steady drone of the unseen highway and the skyline looming in the distance make it clear we're still well within the boundaries of Louisville Metro. But everything about the farm seems old-fashioned. It's as if we've stumbled back a few decades.
The fire and EMS people came back one time and said, you know, we don't know where you guys are. You know, like, you're not on any of our maps or anything. You know, if something were to ever happen back here, we wouldn't be able to help you, so.
Ivor says diners can be more connected with their food if they have an intimate knowledge of how it came to be. While antique machinery can be found strewn about the barn, everything on the farm is hand-picked. And in fact, there isn't much that can be mechanically picked.
Tomatoes can, but you really don't want to eat a tomato that can be mechanically picked because they're cultivated to be hard and to withstand a machine picking them.
Another tenet of the farm-to-table program is eliminating the middleman between growers and eaters. With an urban farm like Ivor's, produce is sold directly through community-supported agriculture. The CSA provides buyers with a weekly box of food for 6 months. But that's a big commitment, and many people are unaware of the benefits of programs that provide fresh foods, which is where the idea for the restaurant came from.
I think the restaurant is an easier step for people to take than it is to say, go to a farmer's market or, you know, subscribe to a CSA. I think, you know, a restaurant like this is a great way to introduce people and kind of, you know, get them interested in the food and then move into more of the politics and the, you know, the other aspects of local food.
Chris Skies is an apprentice at Field Day Family Farm and a food runner at Harvest. The walls at Harvest are lined with large black and white portraits of the farmers who supply the food. When a visitor comes in, they can see exactly who provides their food, and a map at the back of the restaurant shows exactly where it comes from. The restaurant is all about fostering an intimate relationship between farmer and consumer, something that Ivor has been doing at farmers markets for years.
And in my mind, if the restaurant, in addition to delivering great and delicious food, if it also engages more people in the discussion of the local food economy, that's fantastic.
An enhanced local food economy means more fresh food availability, which could help alleviate underserved communities and build a healthier city if the idea spreads. It's a relationship that would benefit both local farmers and consumers. And bridging that gap is the first step. Dalton Main, WFPL News.
Support for WFPL comes from the National Jug Band Jubilee. Presented by the Waterfront Development Corporation, Jim Queskin and 8 Jug Bands keep a Louisville tradition alive this Saturday at the Brown-Forman Amphitheater. This is a ticketless event, open to all. Details at jugbandjubilee.org. From Louisville Ballet's The Three Musketeers, September 16th and 17th, a performance of swashbuckling adventure, action, romance, intrigue, and comedy. 584-7777 for tickets. Listening to Louisville's NPR news station, 89.3 WFPL.
And good afternoon. Welcome back to a WFPL news special on local food. I'm Gabe Bullard, talking with Proof on Main and Garage Bar chef Michael Paley, farmer Ivor Chodkowski from Grasshoppers Distribution and Harvest Restaurant, Sarah Frischner with the Louisville Farm to Table Initiative, and Nathaniel Spencer of New Roots and the Shawnee Neighborhood Fresh Stop. And we want to hear from you, 502-814-8255. Thoughts on local food. How much of your diet is local? Are you wanting to eat more local food but can't find it? Maybe the money isn't there. News at WFPL.org is the email address, or Facebook or Twitter at WFPL News. And not everyone is sold on the local food concept. Joining us by phone now is Pierre Derachet, a geography professor and co-author of the not yet released Locavore's Dilemma book. Pierre, you have some criticisms of this movement.
Well, yeah, I mean, thanks for having me on, first of all. It's good to have, I guess, a foreign perspective on this. Well, my old take on this is that do you care about intentions or results? And what I've always found fascinating about this whole debate is essentially that locavores, as they're commonly known, essentially wants to forward us to the past without ever asking themselves, well, why is it that we bothered, or that our ancestors bothered developing a globalized food supply chain in the first place? And once you start digging into that history, I mean, or even without getting into the details, all of your other guests know that essentially what they want is what Kentucky, I suspect, looked like a century or a century and a half ago. But then a few things happened. I mean, railroads came along and people found it more convenient and more affordable to buy food produced in locations which were better able to grow things that didn't grow as well in Kentucky. And as a result, food became more affordable, nutrition improved, people could leave the farm and worked on other things, and everybody was made better off in the end. I mean, sure, some local farmers had to adapt, some local farmers had to specialize. But if you care about the economy, if you care about the environment, if you care about creating jobs that involve more than picking tomatoes in local fields, then the global food supply chains has a number of advantages that are completely forgotten or misunderstood by local food proponents.
I want to jump in here. Sarah Frischner, you're shaking your head right now, specifically at the line that nutrition had improved, or that everyone had benefited from this.
Well, I'm shaking my head about a lot of things. I mean, where do you go? At least from my perspective, and I will speak from the economical perspective first, because that's where I come from. In Kentucky, we have 84,000 farmers, and most of them are looking for a way to grow something that'll pay them a living that isn't tobacco, because they can't grow tobacco anymore. So from my point of view, from an economic point of view, we have to find something for those farmers to grow, because they are farmers. We can't just make them radio broadcasters or geography professors. We have to find something that appeals to their way of life. And for me, it's food. It doesn't have to be food. It could be grass, or it could be wood, or it could be sod, or it could be racehorses. But from agriculture, food is what I'm interested in. But that's one of, I mean, we can talk, I'm glad to stay here all day.
I mean, why? If you go back to a century and a half ago, 80% of the people were farmers. Today,
but we're talking about a reality. I'm not trying to make anybody a farmer. I'm trying to take the 84,000 farmers in Kentucky that exist who are looking for something to grow that will earn them a living, just like you and I earn a living.
But why should they grow? I mean, my parents were into the maple syrup business, and I had no interest into going down that road.
So you didn't.
And
so big deal. 84,000 farmers want to farm. They've farmed all their lives. They've farmed for six generations. They want to get off the farm, they sell their land to a developer. That's happening all the time. We're fine with that.
What's wrong with
that?
I don't see why you want people to remain farmers for the rest of their lives.
Because they want to remain farmers.
Let me jump in here and referee for a second. Pierre,
Kentucky taxpayers to fork out more money for school lunches, I don't see where the benefit is. I mean, farming should be a profitable business. If it's a hobby, fine. But then all that's taxpayers to pay more for school lunches.
Pierre, let me jump in here for a second in this conversation around the nutrition of local food, the benefits of the industrialized food system. It does enable us, you know, I can go to the grocery store and perhaps buy vegetables that could not be grown in Kentucky and eat that. But the industrial food system, I would think, and, you know, feel free to disagree with me here as well, that's also given us this food, a more monocultural type of diet. Food that maybe is processed beyond what would be healthier than other food, the ability to eat, say, a 59-cent hamburger every day.
Yeah, but I mean, you've been to a produce section recently, I would assume. I mean, can you deny that there is tremendously more choices available now than even three or four decades ago? I mean, you find all sorts of fancy vegetables and leafy vegetables and fruits and things that were simply not available three or four years ago. People have more choices than ever.
And 40%
now, if they don't eat well,
obese.
I think ultimately it comes down to personal
40%
choice.
Of us
right,
are
let's,
obese.
Right. Let's go to Nathaniel here.
Yeah, I'm Pierre, let me ask you this.
Yes.
What's the most important thing about having nutritional food in your body?
Well, that I get the vitamins, the minerals, the proteins that I need.
Sounds like you'll be healthy if you get all that, right?
Yes.
Okay, so to us locally, I mean, the food is going to be healthier local. I mean, look at, you know,
it will be healthier when the food is in season. Where I grew up, the St. Lawrence Valley, you know, our summers are very short.
Well, that's good. My wife is Japan.
No, but that's the thing. What do you eat the rest of the years? You can have very delicious local tomatoes for 2 weeks out of the year and pretty good tomatoes.
If we can let Nathaniel speak his piece here, please, Pierre. Go ahead.
Well, Pierre, look, it's like this, you know, let's just look at New Roots and what we're doing. I mean, we do work with the lower income food desert type communities. And the reason why we do promote local eating, first of all, and organic and chemical free produce is because of the illnesses, the diet related illnesses that are occurring here in our city. OK, we are like our city's obese, you know. Our children, it's like number three in obesity.
It's up there,
you know. And then those that are not obese, they're overweight. Okay, and a lot of this has to do with, first of all, the fast food restaurants. I mean, you look at how how the food is manufactured and processed, and all the, you know, it's like an addiction. You know, it really is. Fast food is an addiction, and so it's important for us here in Kentucky. You know, over 80,000 farmers.
And where does local food come in there? If you can buy good fruits from Pennsylvania or from California, if they're available in your neighborhood, would that not be an improvement over current practices?
I think the argument Nathaniel is making here is that this food isn't necessarily available and that it's not necessarily more affordable than food that would be less healthy. And on the matter of the cost of healthier food versus unhealthy food, we have a Ron on the line right now from Louisville. Hello, Ron.
Hi. My point is that, you know, if a lot of this food that's transported in so easily is transported in because of huge subsidies for the oil industry that makes gasoline so cheap, and huge subsidies to these very large farms. I mean, people who went to McDonald's and bought a hamburger had to pay what it really cost to produce that hamburger, they'd be paying as much as to eat at McDonald's as they'd be paying to eat at Ivor's restaurant. This whole
thanks, Ron.
This whole thing is the thing about it is All this, there's huge subsidies out there for this monocultural agriculture, and if we're wanting to save money, why don't we just cut out all those subsidies, and then have a free market with agriculture, and that would bring all these farms back, all these smaller farms. It costs a lot of money to transport these cattle to these big feedlots where they're fed on something that they're not meant to eat. Which is corn, which is hugely subsidized. Let's do away with all these subsidies, and let's that would bring the local food movement way back up.
All right, Ron, thank you for your call. On a similar note, we have Jackie calling from Louisville as well. Hello, Jackie. You have a similar Hi. Comment on subsidies.
Yes, thank you. I was basically going to say the same thing as Ron, but I can add to that by saying that, you know, with the school food program that they're doing with the local agriculture, you're teaching and changing the culture about how we eat and what we eat, and that's what's most important. And the locavore movement is the only thing that's doing that. I don't see, like, Tyson coming in and teaching the kids about raising chickens. You know, it's something that has to be done on a local level. It keeps jobs in Kentucky, which is extremely important with our unemployment rate at over 9%. I mean, these things are extremely important to our local economy, and by saying that, oh, well, we changed from, you know, local industry because it was cheaper and it was better. Well, that was then and this is now, and things have changed drastically. It's not as good anymore. It's not as efficient. It's not as healthy to eat something that comes from, you know, South America that I can get here.
And Pierre, thank you for your comment, Jackie. And Pierre, what is your thought on what we've heard here about food that is perhaps not
well,
as healthy as
a Canadian, I would say, please get rid of your subsidies, get rid of your trade barriers. I mean, trust me, all foreign producers will be very happy with that. And in the end, though, there is this misconception that transportation matters a lot. Actually, it doesn't. The reason why typically you import food from other location is simply because they have the better soil or the better climate. Transportation, if you factor in the use of fertilizers, pesticide, irrigation, heating greenhouses and what have you, transportation is really insignificant overall in terms of food production. The production phase is really what matters. So this is a complete misconception. If you were to get food began traveling over a long distance long before subsidies to transportation came along. I mean, in my forthcoming book, hopefully it's going to be published in January, I've actually managed to find a number of policy attempts in Pennsylvania a century ago, which are very similar to what your other guests are suggesting today. What happened at the time is that the railroad began connecting Pennsylvania to Delaware, Virginia, Florida, other locations which had simply better conditions to grow stuff. And the Pennsylvania producers could not compete with them at the time. And so they tried to promote local food movement. But in the end, consumers voted with their wallets, and they ended up buying strawberries from Delaware, peaches from Georgia, and other things which they could not produce locally at economically. And I'm afraid the same thing will play out in the end. You don't develop an economy by focusing on the sectors that don't have any economic value or that are not profitable.
We're going to have to take another break here right now. You're listening to a WFPL News special on local food, and you can leave your comment as well. What are your thoughts on eating local, on buying food? How far away does your food come from? Is it something you're mindful of? 502-814-8255 is the number to call to make your comment on the air. You can also email news@wfpl.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WFPL News. And a reminder, also tomorrow we will have a news special on the Sherman-Minton Bridge, some of the effects of that and the political fallout, the future of what might happen. But while we're talking about local foods, we're going to take a look at a man who started a garden in an empty lot right in downtown Louisville. WFPL's Devin Katayama brings us the story of Harlan Smith, who's brought the idea of what it means to be sustainable to the city.
When retired Louisvillian Harlan Smith gardens, this is what he hears. That's because his garden is located on 2nd Street, right in downtown Louisville.
I call it my off-Broadway garden, and since I've been introducing a few animals now, I'm starting to think about changing it to the off-Broadway farm.
It's hard to miss if you walk by, and people often stop to watch the sheep, chickens, and goose that'll come right up to the fence. Jody Taylor walks by and stops to look.
We used to have gardens and pigs and stuff out in the county people would swerve to miss our chickens when they got in the road, but I wouldn't expect to see it here.
It gives you a chance to get acquainted with people easier than...
3 years ago, Smith moved to the Highlands from old Louisville, where he left behind a small garden. He says he walked by this empty lot and asked the property owner next door if he could start gardening, and he agreed. Smith says on Thursdays he'll harvest his crop and open his house for a mini farmer's market in his kitchen. His wife, Carol Grossman, lays out the vegetables on the table, and people from his condo like Bill and Mitzi Friedlander come by and pick up produce.
Now look here. Here's some cabbage. Here are some very wonderful home-laid eggs.
For Smith, gardening is his passion. For others, he says his garden is a chance for people to see something unfamiliar in urban areas like Louisville.
So it gives me a chance to educate some of the kids in the neighborhood and some of the people in the neighborhood. They see my goose, and they call it a duck. I've had them call it a turkey.
Grossman says she thinks educating children about healthy, sustainable living when they're young is a good start, and Jefferson County Public Schools may agree. It began a school garden program at 12 schools last year, and that was extended to 15 more schools this year. Devin Katayama, WFPL News.
Support for WFPL comes from Wave 3, presenting a new up-tempo informative program called America Now. Hosted by Lisa Gibbons and Bill Rancic, America Now presents news every weekday afternoon at 3 o'clock on Wave 3. From the Kentucky Center's Leo A Little Off Center series, presenting the Brooklyn Brun Funk Orchestra performing The Hills Are Alive, blending rock, jazz, hip-hop, R&B, and country into a musical mix as they perform songs from Rodgers and Hammerstein's The Sound of Music, Thursday the 22nd at 8 in the Baumhardt Theater. Tickets at 584-7777 or KentuckyCenter.org.
And good afternoon. Welcome back to a WFPL news special on local food. I'm Gabe Bullard, talking with Proof on Main and Garage Bar chef Michael Paley, farmer Ivor Chutkowski from Grasshoppers Distribution and Harvest Restaurant, Sarah Frischner with the Louisville Farm to Table Initiative, and Nathaniel Spencer of New Roots and the Shawnee Neighborhood Fresh Stop. Also joining us by phone is the co-author of The Locavore's Dilemma, soon-to-be-released book, Pierre Deroche. And I want to get to some calls very quickly. First of all, we have Jason. You had called in. Jason, are you there?
Yes.
Hello, your comment?
Well, I just, you know, I think the big balance for today's topic really is balance is the key word. There's three big areas that I think are huge in this when it comes to an enhanced local food economy. You know, starting off with revenues, keeping the revenues in the state. It's one of those kind of like, why wouldn't you type questions. Why send dollars out of the state for an inferior product when you can buy those things here? And that's where I get back to the balance. You know, the real question of the balance is, you know, shopping local first when you can and making that commitment to your to the local communities to try to buy that product, whether it be tomatoes or any kind of product here, buying it in the local community first, mm-hmm. and then trying to outsource it. The second one is the product themselves. A lot of times with an enhanced local food economy, you have a better product coming from right here locally. With the better product, you get a better taste, and then overall, you get a better experience for the consumer, you know, the customer. In local restaurants and cooking at home, et cetera.
And Jason, thank you. We're running a little bit short on time. I want to get to another call. Thank you for calling. But on that same topic, we have Lynette from Bloomfield calling. You've been growing your own food.
Hi, this is Lynette. I'm so glad that you're having this program today.
Yes. And you've been growing food?
Yes. We live in Nelson County, but we're former Louisvillians and had a large garden when we lived in Louisville. We moved out to a farm here near Bloomfield, and we're doing all that we can to feed ourselves. And I have to say that there were several things that led us to that. First of all, in terms of eating local, I think we should also read local. I think we need to read Wendell Berry, and we need to read Barbara Kingsolver. Her book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, was a real inspiration to me in terms of her family trying to eat local for a year. And so our family is not as dedicated as hers, but we are really trying to teach our son, who's 5, where his food comes from. That food doesn't come in a plastic box from Kroger. It comes from the land.
All right, thank you for your call. We're going to have to keep jumping along here. During the break, a little bit, Ivor, I was talking with you about some of the comments that Pierre had said as far as the advantages of growing food locally. If you could air some of that, and we'll hear Pierre's response.
Well, I was just saying, at some point, Pierre asked, why wouldn't you want to have all this variety and so on? And I think the good answer to that is, at what cost? And if you think about, I mean, there's so many food recalls and people have died. There's a new turkey recall just out here recently. There's been spinach. There's been beef on any number of occasions. And the horror stories about the different fats and so on coming from 8 or 9 different places around the world in order to make a burger. Just thinking about that makes people's stomach turn, inappropriately so. So it makes sense that if, food is industrialized in a way that it really shouldn't be, and the people who work there are not cared for and because of that don't care, that we get a really inferior product. Another thing to think about is, like Ron had mentioned, and the second caller as well, about the subsidy system. The subsidy system really is set up so that the farmers in the United States who are actually producing food on a commodity scale are selling it to the giant agribusiness companies, including ADM and Cargill and Continental and so on, at a price that's under their cost of production. So in order for, and this is why there's so much politics behind it, those companies lobby heavily in order to keep that subsidy system so that they can buy those products under the cost of production and make cheap, really low quality industrial food, which then makes everyone obese, especially in food deserts, which, are a problem not just because there's no good food there, but because there's nothing but bad food, there's fast food, there's lack of transportation, so it's a sort of an accumulation of difficult problems. But the U.S. government then makes up the difference with these farmers, and so it's the taxpayer's burden to go ahead and pay these farmers so that the food system, the global food system, can then deliver this very inferior product that is making us both sick and unhealthy in the long term. You can talk about type 2 diabetes and all the other things that has grown as a result of the food that we have today. And to say that, why wouldn't you, under those circumstances, is really, it begs the question, why would you even think to continue to do what we're doing right now to us in any number of ways? So.
Pierre, your response?
How much time do I have?
Just a minute.
Thank you. Well, local food is a fad that comes and goes. I mean, we had the Victory Gardens during World War II. There were a potato patches movement during the Great Depression. There were other things. Local food never stays because people realize that it comes with a number of problems. First of all, your local farmers will tend to grow the same thing, and their produce will arrive on the market at the same time of the year. Prices will be depressed. The reason why large farmers expanded and reached out to other markets is because they could get better prices for their products by selling to other regions, producing both locally, yes, when it makes sense, but also selling to other people because they were able at a given time of the year to occupy a niche in the market. Second, by keeping your food locally. Well, if you spend more money on food locally, then you have less money to spend on other things, including other things other than food, which might be produced locally. And then if you don't buy from foreigners or from people in other locations, why do you expect them to buy from you in return? I mean, this just doesn't work. Our world became wealthier. We went from a life expectancy in the United States of about 47 years of age a century ago to about 80 years of age today, in large part because of the globalization of the food supply chain.
There's also been advances in medicine that we've seen as well. But now we're also seeing
life expectancy is going down.
At this point, people off the farm. Without having, if you had still 50% of your population working on the farm as opposed to 2% today, you would not have the brain power to develop those medications. Everything is linked.
And, well, one thing to jump in here, we're coming from two different approaches here, but there's one thing that the guests here in the studio are saying and one thing that you're saying, Pierre, but I think we're agreeing upon the fact that one of the symptoms of increasingly industrializing the food system is that it's going to come down to what is lowest cost at this point using that current system. We've talked about some of the ill effects of that, some of the ill health effects of producing food in a certain way. And it's not a matter of saying, I would think, whether or not there's a compromise, but could, and I'll ask this of the guests in the studio, could there be something along the lines of, say, a local food McDonald's, maybe not on health aspects, but on convenience, on price? Chef Paley, I'll ask you.
I mean, I don't see why not. If it's something that's local and not a chain where you're just kind of dealing with your area and the farmers and vendors in your area, I don't see why that wouldn't be possible.
Bluegrass Burgers on Frankfort Avenue is an in-and-out place. You stand to order and carry it to your table, and they use local. They use local bison from Woodland Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And is it a matter, then, of spreading local food to make the food more convenient for people? There's also a lot, and I know Pierre has written about this, and I know it's been addressed before, there's a difficulty in buying food in the rawest form and processing it, and that can be a time-consuming thing for a lot of people, people working, people taking care of children. Is it a matter, then, of just making local food more convenient? Is that the next hurdle to overcome?
It's not a matter just. There is no just. This is a multifaceted and subtle and complex situation, and it's a whole system that needs to change, and that there's not one answer to it. And like Barbara Kingsolver, you know, she went all local all the time. Every family member got to vote for one thing. They, you know, olive oil or coffee, or, you know, nobody does all of anything every time, everywhere.
And that's, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut you off, but there's a lot more conversation here to have, and there's a conversation we'll continue to have on the air here at WFPL in the future. I'd like to thank our callers, and I'd like to thank our guests, Proof on Main and Garage Bar Chef Michael Paley, farmer Ivor Chodkowski from Grasshoppers Distribution and Harvest Restaurant, Sarah Frischner with the Louisville Farm to Table Initiative, Nathaniel Spencer of New Roots, and also Pierre Derrochet, a professor and author of the not yet released The Locavore's Dilemma book. And also, I'd like to thank the WFPL listeners who contributed additional support for our reporting on local food through Story Exchange, and there is more reporting to come. This news special was produced by the WFPL News staff production team, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost. For more information, WFPL.org. I'm Gabe Bullard.